go, Julia. We got cows. Another cow.
Actually, I think that was the same one.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert, and welcome to The Bunker. It's Wednesday evening.
2:22.
2:22.
Yes. Once again, that probably means something.
That we're too obsessed with numbers?
Yeah, probably.
That's what someone said.
7 o'clock Central Standard Time, 0100 Greenwich Mean Time on the 23rd, where they've already gotten past the numerical significance of today's date.
That's right, because 222, of course, is two-thirds less evil.
Of, yes, the beast.
And 666.
Yeah. So we got that to look forward to in another 5 hours. Meanwhile, we've got part two of our interview with Scott Stevens tonight. WeatherWars.info.
You know, we've heard some email back from you guys, and you enjoy that just as much as we did. Only we know how it ends.
That's right.
Ah, yes, the ironic twist at the end of the... Oh, I better not give that away.
That's right, yes. The cliffhanger for season two of the interviews.
Yeah. That's right. Yes.
So, we've got that in a couple of minutes. Meanwhile, we discuss some of the news of the day. Some interesting things going on in the news today. Of course, we have not yet seen much in the American press regarding the depleted uranium story that hit the UK press over the weekend.
No, they're busy talking about the ports, but frankly, I'm glad they're talking about the ports. It's just they're not discussing the aspect of the ports that matters.
No, that, well, that's usually the case in what you get in the mainstream media. Of course, it is interesting seeing Senator Chuck Schumer saying, you know, I think it would be better for Halliburton to take over control of operations at these six ports. So that was bizarre, and once again proved that we have moved into some alternate bizarro world universe.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, another thing is on Fox News this evening I saw, I generally like Major Garrett, but mm-hmm. I don't know if he was told put this piece together in this fashion or what, but he came away with what seemed like a whitewash piece to me of the whole issue, and essentially saying the concern is for naught.
Hmm.
Look, folks, this is no big deal. Look the other way.
And what's really bizarre is that I read an opinion piece by Justin Raimondo from antiwar.com earlier today in which he said basically the same thing. This is a non-issue. The UAE, especially the Emir of Dubai, mm-hmm. One of the seven emirates that make up the United Arab Emirates, is our friend in the Middle East. He's been an ally in the war on terror. He allows us access for military uses.
Well, whether it was public knowledge or not, at one time, supposedly, Osama bin Laden was our friend.
That's true.
At one time, Saddam Hussein was
our friend. Yeah. The point is that an Arab-owned company is more easily infiltrated by those of Arab descent. And mm-hmm. again, let's be honest here. When you're dealing with an Islamic terror group or radical Islamists, you're more than likely going to find that they're recruiting among Arab populations.
Well, yeah. I mean, let's face it. If we were fighting a war on terror mm-hmm. that was primarily against a group of Germanic-speaking peoples.
Right.
Wouldn't it be foolhardy to put Germany in charge of our ports?
You would think so.
Yeah, you would think so.
And
now, granted, we're not at war with the UAE, but
right.
Let's use a different country than Germany. Let's say another Germanic-speaking country. Let's mm-hmm. say
the Swiss.
The Swiss.
They got such dangerous knives.
I know.
So dangerous that little 3/4-inch long pocket knife that I had hanging on my keychain was confiscated as a potential weapon the last time I flew.
Well, it wouldn't be today. By George, you could take bunches of those on
here
today.
That's right. Yeah, it just was too early. Excuse me. Java's trying to bite the headphone cord here.
And that's no good.
No. Java, that's... jive. Well, Doug Hagman of Northeast Intelligence Network came up with a very interesting point on this issue of the ports, pointing out that it's not just six ports that are affected by this sale. Now, of course, the sale is from one foreign company to another, P&O, which is the English company, British company, that it currently oversees operations at these six ports, New York, Newark, New Jersey, Baltimore, New Orleans, Miami, and Philadelphia. There are two additional ports that are under that are part of this deal because of a contract extension of some sort. These are the ports at Beaumont, Texas, and Corpus Christi, Texas. Those ports handle an awful lot of material for the United States military. Fort Hood, Texas, is where we have bases for some of our armored divisions, if I understand it correctly. And so when we ship military assets to points east, like the Middle East, they go through Beaumont and Corpus Christi. And these ports would then be under the control of a company owned by the Emir of Dubai.
You know, that doesn't make me comfortable.
No. No, it doesn't.
I'll tell you what else bothers me about this. You and I were speaking about this yesterday. There are so many things that are being sold off that are United States, well...
infrastructure.
Exactly. The toll road.
We saw this in the newspaper yesterday from Indianapolis. And again, that's kind of strikes close to home because Sharon's folks are from Indiana. Most of my dad's relatives were from Indiana, lived in Indiana for over 100 years before moving to Chicago back in the 1930s. A major toll road that crosses Indiana is up for sale, and the control would be turned over, if the sale goes through, to companies from Australia and Spain. Now, those are nominal allies of the United States. Australia is a strong ally, I would say. But still, again, it's infrastructure inside our country. Why isn't there an American company qualified?
You'd think so, wouldn't you?
Capable of putting together the low bid?
Well, here's what I don't get about it. Isn't the whole purpose of a toll road, the toll is to pay for the road?
Yeah, you'd think so.
And the state pays for the road in the initial phase. And therefore, the state is supposed to, I've always assumed, maybe I'm wrong, I always assumed that toll that I throw in that little basket or give to the person in the booth goes to the state to help defray the cost and maintenance of the road. Well, excuse me, we're selling this off to, what are we doing again?
Yeah, since when have we turned the, now I'm willing to bet that those roads were paid for with tax money.
I'll bet
it wasn't private investors that put up the money to build that road.
Oh, yeah, and I'm willing to bet that some of the Powerball money and all that stuff is supposed to go towards roads as well as education. I am just mystified by it because I tell you what, folks, in another 5 years, if we're still on this earth and Christ hasn't come back and the creek don't rise, we'll be going through a toll booth and someone with a foreign accent is going to be saying, "Your papers, please."
Yeah, that's a very good point. That is a very good point. And there have been some cases where things like that have happened. You know, exercises, of course, exercises.
Well, I'm starting to get creeped out by it.
Well, speaking of the depleted uranium thing, we started on the rant here.
I know. We didn't get through the whole
thing. Well, no, that's okay. I mean, because I thought it was a good segue from the one into the other. But apparently a newsletter went out about a week ago, and it kind of escaped everyone's notice. And then when we started getting this information from Carl Schwartz about the detected, the uranium, the radiation that was detected in the UK, went back and found this article regarding the resignation of the Veterans Affairs Secretary, Anthony Principi, who resigned earlier this month. A newsletter called Preventive Psychiatry, which was sent out about a week ago, February 13th, told us the author of the piece in the e-newsletter, Arthur Burnclough, who is the executive director of Veterans for Constitutional Law in New York, told subscribers to the newsletter that the real reason that Mr. Principi stepped down was because of the depleted uranium scandal that is about to explode. Burnclough said, quote, "The real reason for Mr. Principi's departure was really never given. However, a special report published by eminent scientist Lauren Moret, naming depleted uranium as the definitive cause of Gulf War syndrome, has fed a growing scandal about the continued use of uranium munitions by the U.S. military, end quote. And then he added, quote, out of the 580,400 soldiers who served in Gulf War I, of them, 11,000 are now dead. By the year 2000, there were 325,000 on permanent medical disability.
That's huge.
He says, this astounding number of disabled vets means that a decade later, 56% of the soldiers who served have some form of permanent medical problems. End quote. The highest rate of disability in any previous war, according to Mr. Bernclough, was Vietnam with 10%. 10%. 56% of the soldiers who served in Gulf War I are on permanent medical disability.
I would venture to say that number will be equal or higher with the current war. Can we officially say it's a war that we're in now over there?
This is the war that never ends.
You keep seeing that phrase.
The long war. Yeah. Yeah.
I see it in headline after headline after headline. Rumsfeld referring to the long war. George Bush referring to the long war.
It's as though they want to give this the...
about the long war.
Yeah, this is the name that they want historians to give this war.
Yeah.
For all, you know,
I'd like for it to be the over war, the done war.
Well, this is a shocking number, and I'd like to see some other documentation on this number, because that is astounding. If this is accurate, 325,000 out of 580,000 who served in the first Gulf War on permanent medical disability. Why isn't this a major headline? Why isn't Geraldo doing a story on this?
That's a really good question.
So we need to check on this to make sure that this is accurate. But again, the Preventive Psychiatry newsletter last week put out this story a week before the articles started to appear in the British press about the radiation detected in England from the munitions dropped on Baghdad, almost 3,000 miles away. So this is really, you know, all we can do is just pray that the facts come out, whatever they are. And, of course, well, it would be wonderful if it turns out that this isn't true, but sadly the data is indicating otherwise in terms of the number of birth defects reported in places like Bosnia and Iraq. So we'll keep up on this story and see.
And you know, there's a story out today about a general who is wanted, has been tried in absentia and found guilty from who's, they think, being hidden in Serbia, I think. And forgive me if I'm wrong on that, because it's been a while since I read that. I've had a long day, didn't get much sleep last night. And she's tugging on my blanket right now. Mom, pay attention to me. There's a big story about, because he, you know, massacred so many Muslims, that he's, you know, the equivalent of Hitler in the Bosnian War. It seems to me that what we are doing with depleted uranium, and anyone else who is using this, is worse.
Because it keeps on killing.
Yeah. It's the gift that keeps on giving.
Yep. Well, again, we'll just keep on top of this, because this is a story that deserves to be spread far and wide. And those who are responsible need to be held accountable. That's all there is to it.
She had her collar in her mouth.
And she was losing the fight.
She was. She was running up. It's kind of stretchy. And I don't think it would have hurt her, but it was really making her panic.
And she looked really silly. And it's very appropriate, because we found out today that her mix, the Dachshund Yorkie mix, is called the Dorky. And Murphy says, I could have told you that.
Yeah, not only that, but she's got cooties.
Well, the vet's got that taken care of. So
yeah, turned out she had ear mites. Which, by the way, for those of you who sent notes on Murphy's ear mites, turned out that he has allergies.
Yeah, well, he comes by those honestly. That's me. Yeah. Green, growing, I'm allergic to it.
No, she actually does have ear mites, though, and, well, we fixed that today, so.
Yeah. Well, one quick note on security issues, electronic security issues. I thought this was kind of interesting. Apparently, Skype is a way by which we can communicate confidentially, because Skype's encryption code is something that the NSA cannot break.
Well, the irony there is that Skype is British, isn't it? And didn't you tell me yesterday that's...
Well, Skype was, was originated in the Netherlands, I think.
Probably Finland.
Probably.
Where they have more computers per capita than
anywhere in the world.
Else.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing else to do.
Well, they had glass blowing back in the day.
Yeah, well.
My ancestors came from there, but...
they do that virtually.
That's right, yeah, electronic. So it is interesting, though, that Skype apparently can get around NSA's wiretaps. So for all of this hoo-ha about the NSA listening in on all of our phone calls, everyone is using Skype, gets around it because they can't crack 256-bit encryption that is used to for the voiceover IP codec, I guess.
Yeah, we use Skype occasionally, so if you ever want to Skype us,
Well, just send us an email and we'll tell you the Skype address to Skype to.
Because if we give that out to anybody, then the NSA is going to get us.
That's right. That's right. But the thing is now, Skype has been purchased by eBay. So, I don't know.
Well,
I mean, it could just be, I'm sure eBay's got some designs in mind to make it really easy to just call in your bids using Skype.
That's probably.
Which is probably what's coming.
Yeah, well.
Hey, we haven't done any cryptozoology stuff in a while.
We haven't, have we?
No, and comes
no
word now.
No fluke man or anything.
That's right. Comes word from Malaysia that a group there has announced they have found a tribe of Big Feet or Bigfoots. Sasquatches. Or what they call in that part of the world, Orang Lenggor, meaning the Lenggor people in the jungles of Johor, Malaysia. It's the Johor Wildlife Protection Society. They claim that they found an entire colony of Sasquatch. And their spokesman, Tay Teng Hua, said, "We will make public the evidence soon. The adult creatures are between 10 and 12 feet tall, while their children are 6 to 7 footers. 70% of the Orang Lenggor have a human appearance, but the rest resemble apes."
What's your source on this?
This is this was from a number of different sources. WorldNet Daily carried this story, but I also saw it in a number of different newspapers from that part of the world.
You know, I remember that there. I totally believe you, honey. I just had to ask for our listeners.
Sure,
thing.
Sure.
I remember a story a year or two back. I think maybe it was not so much a news story as something I found online while doing research on giants, and that was that there's an island over there somewhere where there are giants living in the center of the island underground, and all of the natives living on the island are well aware of it.
It's the Solomons.
Yes.
The Solomon Islands.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a fellow who made that claim and said that this has been known since World War II, and he also claims that UFOs fly up and out of the island.
Well, hey.
Yeah. That was a little less well-sourced in this story. But apparently the BBC, according to the New Straits Times, which is a Singapore-based paper, the BBC is sending a crew over there to document this.
Ooh.
And a 7-man crew from a U.S. company that makes film documentaries. So this may be the real deal. Also a Korean film crew from KBS2 television in South Korea.
It isn't the Schrodinger film crew, is it?
That's right. We take a picture of it and it changes. You said 7 to 8 feet tall. Well, okay. On film, they look shorter.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see.
Look, it's only because you're looking at them. Here, don't. In fact, I can be invisible.
As long as you're not looking at me.
Exactly.
Just don't look at me. This is interesting, though, because we've had some discussions going on at the Peering into Darkness forum about the Nephilim, and are there any descendants of the Nephilim still alive today? The giant ape that anthropologists have found, or paleontologists, Gigantopithecus, which stood 8 to 10 feet tall, which, of course, is always classed as a giant ape. You know, is Gigantopithecus really the bones? Are they really the bones of the Nephilim? So,
yeah. Hey, you know, this is a real left turn. Do you like our sound effect there? It sounded more like the Crypt Keeper just came in.
We've got a 16-channel mixer here I could drop in and affect
it. No, honey. No, people expect this.
That's true.
More high quality, you know. Now, I have a question for anybody out there. Has anyone else in any other area noticed empty shelves in major stores? We have seen in Walmart, in Target, in our local grocery store chain, a big chain of stores, empty shelves, lots of them. And this is not the kind of shelves that you see after a big Super Bowl day or, you know, at say on a Monday, you notice that they're low on a certain type of bread. Or no, we're talking shelf after shelf after shelf. In fact, at Target, the store was so empty, I even asked up front what was going on, and I was told by the checker. She said, I don't know. The store really is empty, isn't it? I don't know.
Yeah, at Walmart, I noticed it in the it wasn't the produce, it was the dairy aisle. We've got one of those super Walmarts near us that has food as well as...
Superfood.
Yeah. Well, no, that's wheat,
oh,
wheat juice. But the milk, the dairy case was almost empty. It was only about a quarter full. Thankfully, they had the half and half I needed for my coffee, but...
Well, you know, it kind of makes me wonder what's going on. Is it a trucking thing? Is there a strike going on?
Not that
or
I've heard.
Is and this is connected to a story that's in Watcher today. Apparently, over in Russia, there's a big panic going on for salt and sugar, just basics, staples that you would keep in your kitchen. They are off the shelf and you can't get them.
That is interesting. So we put that to you. Are you noticing anything similar? The kinds of items that would normally disappear, say, before a big snowstorm.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're seeing here, and it's unusual because we don't have a trucking strike going on here in the Midwest. We don't have severe weather. If anything, the weather's been exceptionally mild, 55 degrees here Fahrenheit in St. Louis today. So it's puzzling because we can't think of any good reason why trucks would have been diverted or why supplies would be, you know, off the shelf.
Yeah, by the time I hit the third store in the same day with empty shelves, I was starting to get a very weird feeling inside, and I thought this is possibly what it would feel like if suddenly all trucking stopped. Every time you would go to the store, they would have less and less supplies.
Yeah,
so it was sobering for me, but yeah, let us know.
So anyway, we've got part two of our interview with Scott Stevens, meteorologist and now researcher into the the black science of weather control and weather manipulation.
Hmm. That makes him sound like a wizard.
Yes, but instead of magic, it's science.
Science.
We're back with Scott Stevens, weatherwars.info, as we discuss the changes taking place in the earth around us and the forces behind those changes, whether
they be
physical
or
spiritual.
We're here again.
That's it.
We're still here. I feel like one of the Who. We're here. We're here.
Hoo-hoo.
You two have too much fun.
We do.
We really, really do. And as we've told you privately, we even if we weren't doing this broadcast every day, we talk like this at home. In fact, one of these days we're going to get Nicole on here because she talks the same way.
Yeah. In fact, one of the reasons we were excited to talk with you is that she just recently had a homework assignment for science class in which they had to write a paper about some aspect of lightning. And as we discussed, again, privately last week, the hurricanes that came up out of the Gulf this year, several of them displayed an anomalous amount of lightning. Hurricanes typically don't generate much lightning, do they?
No, and the reason is, honestly, it's rather simple, because hurricanes, the wind fields around hurricanes are horizontal in nature. That's how you get, you know, 60, 70, 80, 130, 140 mile-an-hour wind speeds, is that it is directed horizontally. And to get lightning, you have to have some kind of substantial updraft. And this just goes right to the deployment of this technology we talked about yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that if you decrease the temperature of the top of the clouds, you'll get and enhance that updraft. And when you have Wilma going from a tropical storm to a Category 5 hurricane in under 18 hours, and with an eye that was no more than 2 to 3 miles across, you've got to just shake your head and say, well, here's a pretty good example. We've got violent lightning inside of a rapidly developing hurricane. You know, there's something else at work here. And for those of us that have kind of gone off the beaten path, and it's not necessarily lonely out here, but it is sure a lot more interesting than following the mainstream, you know, we have answers for why these things happen. And yet mainstream scientists sit back and scratch their head and wonder how.
Mm-hmm.
Open your eyes and explore the unexplored.
Boy, that's
and
the
then,
truth.
And then those answers will manifest. They're just there. Other people have done the research and the hard work and the testing. Just open your bloody eyes, guys.
You know, ours are too open.
Well, and then there was the snowstorm in New York City last week.
Yes.
50 inches of snow, record snowfall in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the thing that they talked about that was most noticeable about the storm? Thunder and lightning.
And lightning. I got to ask you, before we leave Wilma, is that the one that had the weird signature, or was it
the two?
The two, yes.
Yeah,
exactly.
From the Mimic website.
Yep.
Those weird, look like fingers or something.
Oh, no. That was,
Which one was that?
Either Rita or Katrina.
Mimic and Katrina.
Right, okay. The fingers that the anomalies that popped up on the radar and then disappeared again, the kind of mm-hmm. pulse.
Yeah. We'll put a link to that site, by the way, for in the show notes, everybody. Mimic website is Morphed Integrated Microwave Imagery.
From the University of Wisconsin. Yeah.
You're good.
Oh.
You are good. You and your acronyms.
Yeah, Sharon stands for something, too, but if I tell you, you got to die. Sorry.
But, you know, that mimic imagery is revealing, but I don't use it a whole lot in my research, and I think people wish I did. But it is data derived from satellite overpasses. And you can't go as long as 8 hours with fresh data. So you're left there with the computer interpolating what it thinks is going to or is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've ever sat down in a severe weather situation and with a line of strong to severe thunderstorms off to your west, do you want a computer interpolating at 15-minute intervals what's going on out there?
No.
Or do you want a live sweep of the radar?
Live radar, please.
And so this is why. The Mimic data has huge gaps mm-hmm. of fresh data. And it is often at the edges of the fresh data where we see these anomalies show up, when the satellite overhead is very, very low or oblique to the surface of the storm it's looking at.
Okay.
So there are issues that show up in there with me. It was curious, though, with the two seen by National Weather Service radar and then, I think it was in Naples or Fort Myers TV station.
That's right. Yeah, Channel 2 down there in Naples.
You know, exactly. That too looks so perfect. I have a hard time believing that occurred naturally.
It was the font of that too was Blue Highway.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. You found the font. You are good.
It was a specific font. Yeah. It was a hurricane, Category 2 hurricane at the time.
Uh-huh.
That eyewall touched the southwest corner of Florida, and that's when the two manifest in the interior. And it was there. It was visible on both the National Weather Service radar and also that television stations.
So and this was something that showed up on the local radar as well as the NOAA radar?
Right. Right.
So this was not something that some jokester at NOAA just put in there as a gag for his buddy working in Channel 2.
Oh, no. They don't have time to do that kind of thing, and let alone to go in and manipulate pixel by pixel that data.
That's
it just
amazing.
Is impossible.
That
it
is
just,
amazing.
It cannot be done.
We'll have to find that image. Do you have that image on your website?
We have it stored on our website.
We do. That's right.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen it,
guys, you've got to see it.
Yeah. I'll make a note to include the image in the show notes.
If you go back to my, archives on my page, October 05, and the article title is Wilma. And that's
okay.
the thumbnail is that two in there.
Okay.
That was bizarre.
We're not done. You know, we had all of those hurricanes in 04 impacting Florida, those four hurricanes
mm-hmm.
we had this past year, and I would venture a guess that we are forecast, whatever you want to call what weathermen do these days, that we'll still see a few along the Gulf Coast in Florida, but the bigger storms, the real quote-unquote terror events, will be farther up the eastern seaboard this year. North Carolina, through the Mid-Atlantics, and then through New England.
You know, Scott, I think you're right, and my reason for saying that isn't scientific. It's because the television movies and specials and even documentaries on the Discover Channel
mm-hmm.
are more and more predictive, and I think that there are people causing that to happen because they're trying to tell us something. The big thing that they're showing now is, in fact, it's on the Weather Channel. They've got... It could happen tomorrow.
It could happen tomorrow.
And a huge storm hitting New York is the one that they're all doing right now.
Which is what? Basically speculating what might happen if another Long Island Express happens to come up. Now, when was that, 1939, when they had that hurricane that hit Long Island?
39 or 44.
Yeah, it was a very fast-moving storm, a very fast-moving storm, so quick that the northeast quadrant of the hurricane, the area that got hit by that, was experiencing 180-mile-an-hour winds.
Hmm. That's ferocious.
Yeah, yeah.
That wasn't Stalin's punch, was it?
But, you know, we saw with Ophelia, and even later with Epsilon and Zeta out in the Atlantic, that they can maintain these storms, these tropical storm force conditions, in wholly hostile environments, with sea surface temperatures easily 10 degrees cooler than what would make most hurricane researchers comfortable. You know, you like to have a minimum of 80, 81 degrees. 82 and 83 is far more conducive for storm development or storm maintaining a storm strength. And we were looking at 68, 69, 70, 71, 72-degree water to maintain these minimal hurricanes and tropical storms. And with gross amounts of wind shear, these storms maintained their identity out in the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an example to say, folks, we could park this on top of Charleston or on top of D.C. or on top of New York City and literally have this thing paper-cutting you for hours and just stick it there. I mean, mm-hmm. the level of control within the atmosphere has developed that far.
Now, when you say these people, who do you think they are?
You know, since let's go back to Stalin that we talked about yesterday, and the development of the energetics project, it needed two items before the global weather modification project, or at least the North American part of it, could commence. They needed magnets. They needed 250-ton maggots. Magnets.
maggots.
Well, that would eat the rot, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But they needed these magnets, and they also needed supercomputers, and those came as foreign aid grants from the United States in the mid-1970s, during the midst of the Cold War.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, wait a minute. There was a company in Indiana called MagnaQuench that was recently the sale of this company to a Chinese firm was recently allowed by the United States government. I think it was within the last, 2-3 years. I'll have to look this up. But it was a company that was producing magnets, and I don't know if they were of this size, but it essentially amounted to a transfer of sensitive technology.
Right.
That magnets that were used for smart bombs. That's it. Smart bombs.
Oh.
It was sold in August of 2000.
August of 2000. So shortly after Bush Cheney came into power.
Mm-hmm.
Well. Oh.
And then the Chinese shut it down in 2001.
Well, they moved it. They moved the operations to China.
Right.
Well, of course. It's the technology transfer.
The technology is what they wanted, and they got it.
Yeah. If you have to buy the company to do it, so be it. It's a small price to pay.
But again,
that research done.
Yeah, but again, I don't know whether those magnets, that company in particular made those magnets, but does the timing of that track with what you see in terms of the technology being employed, or was it happening before that?
Before. We were looking at 1974, 1975.
Okay.
So these were literally magnets that they needed to have in line, 12 of them in consecutive order, and through the tubes, energy taken literally from a Chernobyl nuclear reactor, which was one of them that was hooked up to these scalar interferometers. The Hertzian waves, the regular power waves, would then run through these magnets and then come out the other end as space-time waves. But what we needed was the supercomputers to then model the atmosphere so that they would know when and where to shoot these things off and at the appropriate frequencies and durations and so forth. And 1976 began what was termed the Russian Woodpecker Grid.
I was going to ask you about that. I'm glad you brought that up.
And the Woodpecker Grid began, it was a bicentennial gift from the Soviets to us. And it was contamination of the short wave frequencies from 3 up to 30 megahertz. And you could hear this constant chirping. And it would run for 7 seconds, turn off for 20, turn on for 17, turn off for 30. And it was just this constant recycling of energies. And it was, you know, they couldn't pin down the origination of this very pronounced pulsing. They figured it was Russian, and then there was all sorts of protests, but they didn't get anywhere with it. But that began the weather modification program here in the country. That next winter, as we began 1977, basically standing waves, established high pressure along the West Coast, and the West sunk into a drought. And then Miami saw its first snow ever.
Hmm.
The jet stream had been pushed that far out of its normal range that quickly. What they did not have was the very precise, the ability to put down an F5 tornado as they did in Oklahoma City in 99 and 2000 across the city of Moore. You know, they're just that good now. So as they have had experience, as they have developed more of the technology, as the atmospheric modeling has gotten better over the last 30-plus years, it's a very advanced program. And this is why we have the chemtrail program overhead, is to trace out the lines in the sky to see how the chemtrails disperse, how they display helical twisting, and so forth, is the planes are then laid out to assist and provide surveillance for these electric weather engineers.
Yes, really interesting.
The two programs go hand in glove.
So in the chemtrail, is it some sort of ionic spray?
It is. It's a metallic aluminum and barium, and there is some titanium oxide in there, but there are multiple kinds of spray to be delivered at different places in the atmosphere to give the powers that be surveillance of the weather engineering process as it is underdone. And as I have watched more and more time-lapse cameras watching these planes and their behavior around certain kinds of clouds, I'm of the opinion that these planes assist, very, very tightly assist, the weather engineers in exactly where to turn on and turn off different atmospheric pulses to either add velocity to parcels of atmosphere, to heat or to extract energy, to cool off parcels of the atmosphere, and so forth. And it's a global project now.
So
go ahead.
I was going to ask, how do you know these metallic particles are being laid down?
We see them in the iridescence that is in the clouds, the thinnest of the clouds when they're shown against the sun.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at a normal water-based rainbow, you will get the full color spectrum, all the way from the deep reds through the violets. When you look through clouds that are composed largely of these metallic particles, you get two colors. You get an oily, soapy, waxy color, a salmon color, and also a teal green.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the metals that we see floating in the skies. And this also gives the grid, this electrical grid, adhesion to the atmosphere, the ability to generate clouds and to provide that lift, and also kind of as a nanoparticle-sized gateway to add and extract heat to the atmosphere. And we've seen just since 2000 a twofold increase in the coverage of high cloud cover here over the planet. And that's these artificial clouds. Sometimes they're turned on, again, as geographic locators for the scalar gunners to then target a certain region for an impulse of energy. I have watched clouds, literally one set of clouds, move through another set of clouds as one grid is working against another. Or one is moving south and one grid is moving east, and so you get the atmosphere moving southeasterly in direction.
You mean competing grids of gunners? You mean actually there are different parties of weather engineers that are working at counter purposes?
And that's kind of where I have been looking at this from. That was my vantage point for the better part of the last 2 years. But now watching how these chemtrail planes are working and having had several emails from people who had been in intelligence saying that our military is no more than the gatekeeper for this technology. They do not run it. They simply provide the security for it. And that what the U.S. government built and deployed is no longer under their command.
Really?
So who's commanding it?
That's the elite, the powers that be.
Well, that's something we talk about a lot here.
And this is how Russia got the technology in the first place.
Well, you know, I don't mean to derail the conversation here, but this tracks very closely with what we had discussed with Stan Deo, who said mm-hmm. that it was a sort of Russian, European, North American elite that he was working for down at Pine Gap on the anti-gravity technology, which mm-hmm. sounds like what you were describing as the array of superconducting magnets for the woodpecker grid and what they were using to try to create the anti-gravity UFO technology, but which other parties were hoping to use to open portals between dimensions.
And no doubt that we have had agreements with other civilizations to study, learn, build our own technology rather than having it just straight out given to us mm-hmm. so that we earn that right. We earn that place or that capability rather than having it just given to us, which then proves, well, our use of it would determine whether we were worthy of that gift or not. Mm-hmm. But there are so many things going on behind the scenes that should be a regular constituent of our evening news that just is not and never will be until there's a change of guard.
No, exactly. Well, we know the news. Planet. Oh, the news is so regulated. It's in the hands of a small number of men.
Who are connected to that international elite that you talk about.
I have to ask you a question about something mm-hmm. my sister and I saw here in St. Louis last summer. It was when Derek and I had been on vacation. Every time we leave, a storm hits our house. When we came back, a microburst or something during a very big storm, a huge storm that, in fact, our next-door neighbor described some of the lightning that was taking place as phenomenal. We came back, and the front tree was essentially destroyed. But my sister and I, lights were out, so we're on our back three-season porch facing north, and heavy, heavy cloud cover. Mm-hmm. The storms had just pretty much passed, and we were watching these clouds as maybe 5 in the afternoon in the summer. And so it was not sunset. And I started noticing what I thought was perhaps a reflection in the windows. Because it wasn't screened, they were actual windows so I was thinking, okay, is there a candle? Because I had a candle going, and I thought, is that reflecting? So I stood up and I went over to the window to see what it was, and this reddish glow got bigger and bigger till it actually covered about a third of the sky. And I had my sister stand up and I said, look at this. And the only thing I can tell you is, this is not what I'm saying it was, but this is what it looked like. If you can imagine a glowing UFO taking a third of the sky, that's what it looked like. And wow. I said, at first I thought, well, maybe there's a huge fire somewhere. But no, that isn't what it is. We watched that thing for about a half an hour, and then suddenly we heard a pop and it was gone.
And there... Wow! It wasn't sun peeking through the clouds and creating that beautiful. No.
No.
Okay.
It was the oddest thing.
Here we go. When you are hunting and you take a rifle, the best sight that you're going to use to train the gun on the target is a laser. Correct?
Yeah.
This is what the scalar gunners use to target their weaponry. They use literally balls of light. Plasma balls, plasmoids. And so there were numerous, and it wasn't restricted to just one hurricane, of these sightings across Florida over the past couple of summers. So numerous that I think it was ESH out of Orlando did a story on it. Mysterious orange and red balls of light associated with these hurricanes.
Oh, my goodness.
And these are what Colonel Bearden calls registration devices. So that you get a location, you get an intensity, and basically the geographic latitude and longitude and elevation, a place in 4D space and time to register these devices, register to these scalar interferometers. And the existence of the lightning that you talk about kind of tells us that they were hard at work there.
Hmm. And it's strange because it was July 4th weekend, two summers in a row here mm-hmm.
in
just outside St. Louis that we took some damage in that tree in 2004, and then last year the tree was sheared off above 20 feet. It was about a 45-foot maple. It was just sheared in half.
And it literally looked like it targeted our house because the rest of the street was fine.
Well, a neighbor up the street did have a tree on the corner that was damaged.
Yeah, that's true. But it wasn't like a straight line wind came through and took everything out. It was like it was targeted on our front yard.
That is something that is capable. I mean, those downdrafts can be focused on an area probably no larger than about 50 meters. It's that good. And
could something like that be used to target, I mean, with such precision that they could take down an airplane?
Yes. Oh, yes. I don't even know that you would need to use a downdraft. You would go into what's called endothermic mode and literally extract the heat out of that area. And in extracting all of the heat, you flame out the engines.
And could it take down a shuttle?
Bearden says it's happened twice.
I wondered about that.
The two shuttles we have lost have been a direct attempt to get us to essentially abandon our space program.
Wow.
We've built the Russians a space station because we simply don't have the courage or the will to go back there and risk losing another shuttle. And so now the space station has essentially been abandoned. And I think that there's probably a deeper reason other than just, you know, humbling this nation's space program, but it's simply that there is a... there are other entities up there and other information would become available if we continued our pursuits into space.
Well, the other entities is going to have to leave you hanging.
That's right.
Until tomorrow.
We'll
it's
pick
that
up
time, huh?
It is that time, yes.
Go quickly.
Scott Stevens, weatherwars.info is his website, and we'll continue this discussion tomorrow on PID Radio.
That's part two with Scott Stevens, weatherwars.info. You want to go there and check anything out? You sure can. We've got one more part, though.
Mm-hmm.
Part three coming up.
We'll discuss a little bit more about where all of this is going and what forces are behind this desire for the groups of elite, power elites to control the weather, which is so critical to just basic survival.
Yeah, and we'll give you a clue. If you haven't figured it out already, Scott takes a slightly different take on it than we do.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's worth listening to. Again, it is not the approach that we, you know, it's not that it's the conclusion we draw necessarily, but he's seeing the same things we are, and I think that's what's important.
Right. The data is there, and from the data we draw our conclusions as to who or what is responsible. And we may not agree eye to eye, but that's, you know, we need to know the data so that we can make those conclusions, draw those conclusions. Again, weatherwars.info is his website. Our email for your comments and questions is radio@peeringintodarkness.com.
And come join us at the forum. It's family friendly. It's, it's a whole lot of fun, folks.
It is family friendly.
Basket.
And by the way, congratulations to forum regular and blogger extraordinaire John Wilkerson and his wife on the birth of Alexis, their new daughter.
Yeah. Has she signed up for the forum yet?
Not yet, but I'm not sure she's home from the hospital yet.
Well, as soon as she gets home, I bet she signs up.
I don't
up.
Think they've got wireless access in the maternity room.
It's probably got other things.
At least not in the nursery.
Well, you can join there, of course, at peeringintodarkness.com/forum. And until tomorrow, I'm Sharon Gilbert.
I'm Derek Gilbert. Thank you for listening to PID Radio.
Bye, everybody. Gonna step up to the microphone.